Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hello and welcome to The Art Detective with me, Dr. Yanina Ramirez. I'm an Oxford art historian, a broadcaster and a writer, and I'm also your chief investigator of images. I am joined today by Kate Wiles, who is senior editor of History Today and a researcher on scribes and manuscripts. Today, I am extremely excited. We are in a very funky cafe in Soho. So if you can hear the sounds of some reggae music coming over the sound system, just try and listen to our voices instead. But I'm doubly excited because this is my passion area, Anglo-Saxon manuscripts. And you and I have been chuckling away about a new book that you're reviewing, which tells us that all Anglo-Saxon manuscripts are indeed fakes.
Yep.
But we don't think that is the case, do we, Kate?
I'm quite convinced they're real because I've seen and handled many of them, mm-hmm. and I'm pretty sure they're there.
So tell me a bit about your research area, because it fascinates me.
So I work on Anglo-Saxon charters, which are small brown legal documents from the period about 500, well, they start about 700 to 1066, and they're recording transactions of land. So someone, the king or the church, will give or buy land to someone else, and they make a record of that. And I look at how the scribes write that down, what language they're using, because this is where you start to get the first instances of English being written down in what would otherwise be a Latin context. So it's very exciting to see how they're starting to use their own language and kind of seeing it slowly creep in and take on Latin, which is quite nice.
Yes. Well, that's it. The linguistic transformation is absolutely fascinating. My background was in literature originally, and then got into the art history later on. But the idea that the vernacular, English, the language that was spoken, and the relationship there is with this written language of the church, which is Latin, is absolutely fascinating. And the Anglo-Saxons do something quite unique with the two, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that they even start writing in their own language is pretty unique. On the continent, you see only the tiniest bits of it for a very long time after. And really, England, for some reason, is this outpost in Europe, just doing its own thing.
Do you think it's because of Gregory the Great? Because we've got this mixed account, haven't we, in Bede?
Yeah.
That when he sends over the missions and St. Augustine, he said, in one account it does say, you know, get rid of all the heathen practices, be very strong.
Yeah.
But in another, he does say, don't actually destroy the temples and the places that people are used to going to, just remove the idols from them. And I wonder if that creates this sort of sense of adaptation rather than destruction that comes in with Christianity.
I mean, there's a lot of continuity that you do see pagan practices just being absorbed, not replaced.
Yeah.
I can't comment on the continent, I'm afraid. I don't know enough about it. But I think to a certain extent that happens on the continent as well, that that's the best way to get people to adopt Christianity is to map it onto what they already know and make it acceptable. You know, it's why we have Christmas when we have it and Easter when we have it. And
exactly.
It's, you know, it's a smooth transition. So, excuse me, I don't know how wildly different England is in that respect. But then the English doesn't start coming in for a couple of hundred years after St. Augustine converts the thousands in Kent. So I think it's just their own innovation that there, you know, there's various influences that go on. Alfred the Great, of course, is
hugely
proponent of their own language. Starts translating loads of things into English, which is a really novel enterprise. Mm. No one else has done that.
Yeah. And he writes his own account. He translates texts from Latin into English.
Yeah.
And then he writes this beautiful personal account, doesn't he, at the beginning of Gregory's Pastoral Care, where he says, you know, these are the books most needful for all men to know. We have to save it and put it in our own tongue.
I mean, he's really invested in it, and he realises that the masses don't speak Latin, and he wants the Bible and the biblical texts to be understood by the people to make them better Christians.
Yeah.
Because if they're Latin, then it's closed off. You know, you can see the beautiful manuscripts, you can see the images, but you go and listen to a sermon, you have no idea what's happening.
Yeah.
So putting it into the your own language is a huge step.
Yeah. And it's something that really, I mean, it's very timely at the moment with the celebrations of Luther and the 95 Theses, because that is all about putting the scriptural text into the language that people understand and speak. But the Anglo-Saxons are doing it hundreds of years earlier. They're awesome.
I know.
They're awesome.
Oh, love them.
We have raced ahead somewhat, because this is an art detective podcast and we have an artwork. Yes. That we are absolutely ready to salivate over.
So, I mentioned earlier that charters are drab and brown and small. They're very small. They're, you know, they range from 6 inches by an inch and a half to maybe 20 inches or something, and they're brown. There's nothing on them, and I've got one.
Yeah.
And it's illuminated.
It's amazing. It's an
illuminated. It's actually got gold on it.
Well, this is where I get excited, because you do all the text.
Yeah.
In fact, just before we say what we're looking at, I am fascinated to discover that you are the linguistic consultant on the TV series The Vikings.
I am, yes.
This is so cool.
Thank you.
So you have to, you all get all the old English run by you and help out with all the old Norse. And
they send me lines of dialogue and I translate it. I have tried to put in lines from Monty Python, but
just slide them in.
Yeah, I did. My hovercraft is full of eels, but I don't think they used it.
I don't know if anyone would know if they did. But no, that's just...
Min flotship is alles full, is my floaty boat is full of eels.
My floaty boat, that.
Thank you.
That deserves a round of applause, Kate. That is absolutely amazing. So no, I'm hugely impressed by that. So yeah, the language in this is fascinating to you.
Yes.
The art in this is fascinating to me.
Yes.
We are looking at a manuscript that is called the Codex Aureus, and it's now in Stockholm.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an Anglo-Saxon manuscript.
Yes.
Probably made in and around Kent, isn't it? In the mid 8th century?
Something like that, yeah. We can't pin it down exactly.
Yeah. In the wonderful world of early medieval art history, we don't have dates. We have relationships between manuscripts. So one is later or earlier than the other. So we know roughly the school that this is coming out of. It's coming out of that sort of Southumbrian school.
We can recognise similarities with other things that were produced at that time. Charters are particularly useful. I'm going to bang your charter.
You're going to insist on these charters,
aren't
you?
They have dates on them.
Yes, indeed.
So if you've got a charter with a date and you can match the scribe to something else similar, that's how you can date a bigger manuscript.
Excellent. Well, you are helping me on that front. From an art historical point of view, it's fascinating, isn't it? Because like many of the manuscripts I'm slightly over the top in love with, like the Lindisfarne Gospels, like the Lichfield Gospels, there's a blending of influences and cultures that's coming through in this manuscript, isn't there?
Yeah.
What do we see?
So, it's got some Carolingian stuff going on. It's very continental in its style. It's kind of Italian influences, because the scribes are kind of enmeshed in this global world. You know, they're getting influences from all over the world. They're copying. So this is, we mentioned St. Augustine earlier, the images in this manuscript are copied from the Gospels of St. Augustine that were sent over by Gregory the Great. So you've already got this link to Gregory's work. You've got English scribes and illuminators putting their own style on it, picking up influences from kind of the Roman influence to make it look important. So the script they use throughout is uncial, which is, you know, gives it authority. It's a biblical text. So
I always try and do this with my students. What's the difference between uncial, majuscule, minuscule? Uncial is capital letters, really, isn't it? And it takes longer to write than something like minuscule, which is joined up, because you have to separate each letter, and it looks very grand, and it's the sort of script that's used on Roman inscriptions, isn't it?
It's lots of straight lines.
Yeah.
It's very dramatic and bold, and it kind of to a contemporary reader, it just screams authority. It goes, this is from the Pope. You know, this is big, serious stuff. You
and it's coming out
this.
Of the Roman Empire as well, because you've got that idea of kind of triumphal arches with big unsealed inscriptions carved on them.
And you see it directly on the images themselves on the manuscript, that they're putting the arches right onto the page.
Yep.
The content page of these manuscripts has got literal columns
actual
and
actual columns, exactly. I mean, even in this evangelist portrait of the evangelist Matthew that we're looking at, you've got, the architectural framing is all chiming back to a Roman tradition as opposed to the classical tradition. I mean, it is fascinating the way that they have obviously been copying things that have come directly from the continent, but they've added their own insular flavour, haven't they?
Oh, I love it when they do that.
Yeah, me too. Who needs to do a boring, plain copy when you can bring a bit of Anglo-Saxon? Just for the listeners, to give a bit of context on the date that this is happening, so that this manuscript is being made. Mid-8th century, in and around Kent, we are talking very much a Christian setting, aren't we? But the world has changed because up until 597, that magic date, where everybody woke up and realised they were in fact Christian.
Oh, yes.
Everyone, overnight. They're just like, Odin was wrong, Jesus is right. They just realised.
It's a miracle.
Population. I know.
Augustine was great.
He was so
he did good work.
But so this idea that the coming of Christianity, it's certainly had a massive and profound and quite immediate effect in the south, didn't it? But it was blending into a culture that was already many hundreds of years old, which was an Anglo-Saxon, Germanic, pagan, warrior culture that differed in many ways from continental Christian Europe, didn't it?
Yeah, they're very much forging their own identity. They start referring to themselves as the English. They've, even though England is made up of separate kingdoms and each of those has its own identity, they're very aware that they're a separate thing. And that they're at the outer limits of the Christian Empire when it does arrive. You know, they're very aware that they're a little outpost.
It's amazing in the Codex Sabbatina, it's my favourite.
Just going to mention that.
Oldest surviving single pandect copy of the Vulgate Bible anywhere in the world. And it was made at Bede's Monastery up in Wymouth Gerry, just outside Newcastle. That is a claim to fame, Newcastle.
It's amazing. And I have to give my favourite fact. This is from Christopher Hamill's Meetings with a Remarkable Man. Manuscripts, which is my favourite book
ever made.
I love it. Yeah. But he says, he describes the weight of this manuscript because it's enormous. It's 75 pounds.
Well, how does he give it? Because the traditional one is...
So the Lindisfarne Gospels, 20 pounds, are the weight of an adult badger.
There you go.
The Codex Amiatinus, 75 pounds. Rupert Bruce Mitford describes it as the weight of a fully grown female Great Dane.
Absolutely.
Christopher de Hamel weighs in and said, or a 12 to 13 year old boy.
I have been using the Great Dane in all my lectures.
Fully grown female.
Fully grown female. It has to be a female, because if it was a male, it would be ever
too
so
much,
slightly too heavy.
Yeah.
That is incredible. 12 to 13 year old boy.
It's quite precise.
Wow.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, the Codex Amiatinus is an extraordinary manuscript.
Yeah.
It takes two people to lift it. I mean, I've seen the facsimile. I've never seen the original, despite having researched
it. The one you've seen the facsimile in Wymouth Jarrett.
Yeah. And handled it.
It's so huge.
It's huge, so huge. But the inscription in that actually says, you know, we are from the edges of the world. We are from the ends of the known world. So they knew that they were an outpost. They knew that these newly converted... They knew they had been pagan. That's the other thing.
They held on to it still.
Yeah.
And they kept... I mean, if you look at the place names, for example, place names often maintain, you know, because you can't just rename... You do sometimes rename a place, but it often have the memory of what was there before. And you get an awful lot of kind of place names that have Thor in them, or Woden, or Heorg, which is a pagan temple.
Yeah, we've got Wodensdenu near us, which is Woden's Valley, which I love.
Yes.
Wodensdenu. Yeah.
I like Peperharrow, which is the Piper's temple or shrine, but we don't know what the Piper was, but it was something pagan.
But no, place names are great. Names of the week, of course, the days of the week, all going back to the pagan gods.
Mm-hmm.
And also these little echoes that we get coming through in Bede and in other texts that sort of hint at
earlier practices. Genealogies as well.
Yes.
Where very often a king will to show his authority and he's descended from Jesus, but then it goes back to Woden.
Absolutely.
So they're kind of merging the two together in their very own kind of unique blend of religion that works for them.
But that's what I definitely think we have coming through in the Codex Aureus in terms of blending.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is fully paid up Christian text. This is the text of the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. And it's huge. I think there's 197 folios.
Goodness.
I think it's 197 folios. And what I absolutely adore about this, and what tells you how expensive and incredibly important it was, is that it's dipped. Half the folios are dipped purple dye, which is only for imperial manuscripts, isn't it?
And then it starts to be used for some royal ones, but it's so rare.
So rare. So what I love as well is because it alternates.
I know.
That idea. And then they change colour of ink. So on the purple, they write in gold.
It's just phenomenal. It's the most beautiful thing.
It is. Astonishing. So look at us. I'm getting a bit giddy over the Codex Horus. But it's also the oldest surviving example of the use of gold leaf in an initial, isn't it?
Yep. Which is a big innovation, because we talk about these really highly decorated gospel books, and there's an awful lot coming out of the British Isles and Ireland at that time. You know, the Book of Kells, for example, is phenomenal, but it's not got gold on it.
No.
It's not.
Yeah.
Pretty sure it hasn't.
Well, the Book of Kells is later than this anyway, so we can cover ourselves.
The Lindisfarne Gospels, the Gospels of Augustine, there's no gold. We refer to them as, you know, highly decorated, but this is the first time you get one illuminated.
Yeah. And that's the word, isn't it? Illuminati. It's actually coming from the idea
of the light
bringing out from the gold.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, this one is called Codex Aureus because that is the word for gold. It literally means the gold book, doesn't it?
And it is a big feature.
Yeah.
I mean, just on this spread that we've got here, you can see with, it's, you know, quite low res, but you can just see the gold shining off it.
Totally.
And, you know, opening with the massive, the XP, the Cairo, which means Christ. It's starting with a splash, and it's really giving all the authority they can to this text.
Yeah, and this is the opening to Matthew's Gospel, which is the first, traditionally the first in the New Testament, and it starts with the genealogy of Christ, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So it's opening up with, as you say, Cairo for Christus, and then going into to tell about his birth, his life, his ancestors. Yeah. But the Cairo, stylistically, this is something quite extraordinary, isn't it? Because we don't see this in continental manuscripts, do we?
You have to tell me about this.
Well,
I don't know about the art side of it as much.
We don't.
It looks very familiar to me because this is what I...
Yeah, because you do insular manuscripts. Yeah. Insular, by the way, is for the British Isles. It shows this blending of Irish Celtic influence with Anglo-Saxon Germanic style. But this is quite extraordinary because while on the left you've got this image of the evangelist seated in this architecture, which does look quite classical and it looks quite Carolingian, actually. It's quite... Although they have abstracted slightly on the facial features, which is a good old Anglo-Saxon trick. But if you go over to the initial, here you've got all these amazing quills and spirals, which are coming straight out of Celtic art.
I was going to say, that to me looks just like the Cairo page of the Book of Kells.
Exactly. And this is a tradition that goes way back. You can trace it back through to the Bronze Age and beyond, where Celts use these triskels, these quills, these spirals, these trumpets on their art. And it's, for me, I love it because it's always about pushing against the boundaries. It's this idea of sort of the freedom of the space. But then at the end of the X, you've got these two animal heads.
Oh, yeah.
Can you see that? And that's very Anglo-Saxon, because the Anglo-Saxons love their zoomorphs. They love their beasts.
So this is kind of connected to our Viking art that is really keen on its...
Exactly. Exactly. So they're already just in that one little section there. They seem to be combining the influence of Roman Christianity, the influence of Ireland and Celtic Christianity, and then this legacy of animal zoomorphic art that comes through from hundreds of years of warrior culture of the Anglo-Saxons.
Brilliant.
So that's the art.
Yeah. I mean, I can talk about the XP if you like.
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
We could do this weird blend of linguistics and art history.
Please, yeah.
So the XP is something that goes back to the very earliest days of Christianity. XP are the first two letters of the word Christ if they're written in the Greek alphabet. And, you know, it carries on to spell out the rest of Christus. The Emperor Constantine in... when was he?
312.
3rd, 4th century.
Yeah, 4th century.
Went into battle under a banner with XP written on it. Won. Decided it was his lucky charm. And that kind of fixed the XP as a symbol, particularly in, again, a non-literate world. You can see the symbol, you know that that's Christ. On this page, it's the biggest bit. So someone looking at it who doesn't read Latin, and I mean, even if you do read Latin, the rest of the page is quite hard to read. The symbol becomes more potent than the word Christ itself.
Absolutely.
We have then continued the X, and that's why we have Xmas instead of Christmas.
Ah! And of course, you know that relationship between X and the crucifix as well.
Yes.
Symbols, yeah. You know, this is my other passion area. Yeah. How powerful just that opening symbol can be. I also get very excited about the relationship you see in Anglo-Saxon manuscripts between text and image, because what's so interesting is that here you've got the evangelist page. In things like the Lindisfarne Gospels, you've also got carpet pages before that. But the way that the image prepares you for the text, and then you come through image, through this decoration, into words, it's like the visual is the preparatory material for these sacred texts that's coming.
And that's where you've got clues like the evangelist with his symbol, the man.
Exactly.
And so that tells you again, even if you don't know what the words say, you've got all of the visual information so you can look at it and know what you've got.
Exactly. And I think that also feeds into something that I'm sure you're interested in as much as I am, which is this idea of oral recitation, the idea that a lot of things are spoken out loud, and books like this would have been read from and used as teaching aids, but also, you know, there to be kind of public items, aren't they?
I mean, everything about them is built for being read aloud. The punctuation, the word spacing, the line spacing, everything is there to tell you when to take a breath.
Yeah.
And they were kind of put out on public display, and someone would read from them. You very rarely get anything that you can really say was meant to be read internally. And in fact, I can't remember what the reference is. There's someone goes to visit someone and he's reading silently, and that's noteworthy enough to write down.
Do you know one of the weirdest things that we, again, I'm always fascinated by the way that we look back from a modern perspective onto the medieval and our notions of reading and of books and what they actually function as are completely formed from our modern point of view. One of the earliest examples of a person quietly reading by themselves in their room silently is in the Henry VIII Psalter, where he sat with his own book in his own bedroom reading.
And it's a private thing.
But almost all books really were read, even if a person was by themselves, they would probably read out loud. And we sort of forget about that, don't we?
I think it's particularly you get it with the English, is that the spellings themselves reflect the pronunciation. You can't, if you're reading Old English, you can't escape that it is an oral thing. It's directly reflecting the spoken language, and it's a mystery exactly how the spellings worked. I still don't understand it after years and years. And Latin is a different thing again, and that's another part of the difference between Latin and English, is that Latin was fixed spelling and artificial and written down. and was a very different beast from English.
Well, English, as it continues to do, transforms, and it transforms very rapidly. Yeah. So even in the Anglo-Saxon period, you've got dialects from all over different places, and then you've got text written at different times, and sometimes they can be completely impossible to make sense
of. And then you've got a scribe who may have moved, and so they were trained in the south, but they're writing in the north, and they're copying a text from the east, and you get all of those influences, and it's bane of my life.
Brilliant. It's brilliant. So Lisa, tell me about the text that is surrounding this gorgeous, beautiful set of illuminated words. What is going on with this little scribbly stuff that look very ugly?
I mean, rude. So the thing about manuscript pages, and I can't remember who said this, I read it years and years ago, that someone said a manuscript page is not like a modern book, it's more like a Wikipedia page, that it's not a finished thing. We print a book, it's published, you don't touch it. You know, people who write in the margins of their books are frowned upon.
I do it, always have.
I mean, I do too, but only my own books.
Yeah.
But these, you know.
True.
But a manuscript page, once it's written, one scribe will write it, someone else will come along and edit it and correct it. Someone else will, if it's Latin, someone else might come along and write Old English between the lines.
As in the Lindisfarne Gospels, which has one of the earliest surviving transliteral versions of the Bible into English.
And it's great. I love it because even the most obvious words, they've just put a little note next to it going, this is book.
Yeah, exactly. Bok.
Bok. Oh, thanks. But that's, you know, to help readers access. And then as the centuries go on, more and more people add layers and layers of additions. And so what you end up with is this amalgamation of things. So on the page that I brought today, the Codex Aureus at some point was stolen by the Vikings from wherever it was being held. And then afterwards, Ealdorman Alfred, who was the kind of the local ruler of Surrey under the king, ransomed it back with his wife in pure gold from the Vikings and donated it to Canterbury in exchange for the community at Canterbury praying for his and his wife's and his daughter's souls for as long as baptism shall last on this land. And please don't take the book away from Canterbury for as long as there is Christianity in England.
Amazingly, it ends up in Sweden in 1600.
So, sorry, Alfred.
Yeah, but it kind of worked out.
I'm sure his soul's fine.
This is fascinating, this inscription. I use this example when I talk about the Vikings and what they get up to, because this is just gold dust of evidence, isn't it, this inscription?
Brilliant. We know, we can date it quite reasonably to around 871 or 2, because we know kind of what the Vikings were doing in Surrey at this time. We know about Alfred and his wife because they wrote a really big will, where he talks about, you know, what he wants all his property to go to, his wife mostly, after he's died. And it's in English, going back to the language thing. So in a culture that is still predominantly Latin, this is written in English, and charters are still mostly Latin, but from about 845, English starts creeping in.
And that's good. That's Alfred, a lot of that as well, isn't there? There's a lot that comes with Alfred.
This is what my research is on at the moment, is trying to work out exactly how and why they start using English, because it's such a rebellious thing, particularly in a legal text.
Well, I think it's rebellious, but I think it's also out of necessity. I mean, Alfred gives us one reason, doesn't he? He says that, you know, the Vikings actually did a number on the monasteries of England. And monasteries, I mean, this is something, again, that I think we have these modern words for things that we associate a monastery with, a nice quiet place with little monks and herb gardens. But actually, a monastery was everything. It was education systems, it was hospitals, it was legal systems, it was publishing houses, all melded into these powerhouses.
We've got records of them fighting with swords against the Vikings. So, you know, they weren't sitting there in their little cloisters not moving.
No, exactly. When you wipe those out, and you're wiping out the roots of all that Latin education and all that research and learning.
And in Canterbury that we're looking at the moment, you see a real deterioration in the scribal quality. I mean, not to be mean, but some of the charters from Alfred's period, King Alfred's period, look like a child wrote them.
Absolutely.
Bless them.
Yeah.
And the Latin is incomprehensible. Like, we have trouble translating them. So that again, might be a reason why this scribe, who has a beautiful hand, beautiful handwriting, so clearly very well trained, but maybe doesn't have the Latin anymore.
Yeah.
The education's been disrupted because of this period of constant raiding.
And I think this is the other reason that this manuscript excites me so much. So it's called the Codex Aureus. It's covered in gold. It's got the earliest example of golden initials. Its ransom is paid in pure gold, as the inscription says. But what it also tells me about is this story of Viking attacks on monasteries, because It brings to light this old cliche that the Vikings were just raiders and that they just indiscriminately smashed everybody.
Yeah.
But the problem with monasteries was they were ripe picking, weren't they? Because they were often on rivers or on the edge of the coast.
They need the resources to be such a big enterprise.
Exactly, so they're importing ivory and vellum. But that means that Viking ships can just come on up
to the doorstep.
Up to the doorstep on the tide.
Yeah.
Grab the unprotected gold and loot that's in those places.
Because the monasteries had so much wealth in there, so all the beautiful things.
And also, they were used as safe houses for royal treasures, because no Anglo-Saxon would attack a monastery, so the Vikings could just grab all this wealth and get out on the tide again.
Yeah.
And this book was taken ransom. Now, that's what I find so fascinating, because the Vikings are not using manuscripts, but they are recognising the value that the Anglo-Saxons place on the manuscripts.
Also, the cover of it, which we don't have anymore. We've got a few covers surviving that might look like the one that was on the Codex Aureus, but they are gold and covered in gemstones. I mean, you don't need to look inside to know that this is a really expensive item. And there's a good chance that the Vikings would have kept the cover. That's really what they were interested in. They didn't care about the inside, which is why Alfred was then able to negotiate it back.
You're absolutely right. And even in the dedicatory inscription in the Codex Aureus, it says that there was a goldsmith who worked on the book and the cover, because we do find these fragments, don't we, that look like they've just been prized off the front. So you have this vision of Vikings who are not using manuscripts, not using books in that way, running in, finding the gold, peeling it off, and chucking the book off, the manuscript away. And then all these monks running back with their books going, I've got it. And they get wise to this. Yeah. And they think, why are they so happy that they've still got those square things?
Can I barter this for money?
Can I get some money out of this situation? Oh. And they do, and that's the thing. So they can ransom it back.
And then bless Alfred comes along with all of his gold and really begs for it and gives them, it says in the text, pure gold. I mean, he really wants this.
Yeah, absolutely. And you had some things about the female influence in this as well, didn't you?
So what's really striking about this is, one, it's in English, two, Alfred's wife, Werburg, is really prominent in it. The text refers to we too. You know, they're a couple. They're doing this together. It's not just Alfred. And then their daughter is also mentioned. And one of the ideas is maybe it's written in English so that she can read it and their daughter can read it, once Alfred's gone, or, you know, someone can read it out to them and they will understand that their dedication is on this unbelievably beautiful thing. And again, I like the kind of the ego that they've put it on really early in the manuscript, on the splashiest page they can find.
Exactly, you know, open up. We did this,
and this is going to do their souls a lot of good. So one of the theories is perhaps it was in English because perhaps Werburg herself wrote it. If it was in their possession once they got it back from the Vikings, we know that Anglo-Saxon women were often literate in Old English and they taught their children to read in English. So there's the famous story of King Alfred and his mother saying, if you can learn these English poems, I will give you this book, and he went away and did it. It might not be true, but the fact that his mother is engaged in the process of learning English suggests, you know, that it could be the case here. And so I love the idea. I don't know, this is from Nicholas Brooks and Susan Kelly, and it's a lovely idea, but we've got no evidence for it. But I would love it to be true that she sat down and wrote it and kind of enshrined her family in this document. It would be wonderful.
Well, I do like that idea, and I don't think it's too far-fetched when we even think down to modern-day family Bibles, where you have different records made in the front covers, and different births, deaths, marriages and events all recorded. It makes good sense to suggest that this could be by somebody involved with the retrieval of this manuscript, particularly given the fact that this is a time of change within Anglo-Saxon scriptoria and scribal activity. So why not an educated noblewoman doing this?
And at a time perhaps when the scribes have not got time to be doing this stuff and their education is waning, she was perhaps educated earlier in her life, because the handwriting is similar to scribes who worked quite a bit earlier. So it's either someone who was trained by a very old scribe or someone who is very old themselves writing it. So she learned to write in her childhood, then later in life. So it's a possibility.
Well, this is the weird and wonderful world of paleography and handwriting detective work and manuscript studies. I mean, This has been absolutely fascinating. I have so loved talking to you, and I could talk to you about manuscripts till the cows come home. It's a huge passion project for both of us, isn't it? But you've really brought it to life for me and made it really, really exciting. Thanks so much, Kate.
You're very welcome.
You're on Twitter, aren't you?
I am.
What's your
Kate Mund. It doesn't mean anything. Kate Mund. Yeah.
Excellent. And I'm also on Twitter. I'm Dr. Yanina Ramirez. If you've enjoyed this podcast, why not subscribe? You can go to historyhit.com/artdetective. And another reminder that History Hit are doing amazing and great things at the moment. History Hit TV is going to be launching soon, thanks to the crowdfunder work that everybody's been so generous in contributing to. So do go to historyhit.tv to find out more. Thanks, everybody. I'll be back soon.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.